Hi, this is Greg Corumbus. Jim Garrity and I are both on vacation this week. We'll be back on June 25th, and Thursday and Friday of this week, there will be new episodes with guest hosts. But for today, please enjoy this best of episode of the Three Martini Lunch.
Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have all good martinis today. Good across the board. Although the third one is not necessarily what we would love to be talking about in a good martini, but we'll get to that in a little bit. We also want to tell you that we are sponsored today by Dollar Shave Club. Right now, for just $5, you can get the Daily Essentials Starter Set, dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Much more on that a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with our good martini. And for that, we go to the White House, where on Wednesday, President Trump, Fox News reports, signed into law a bill that would allow those with deadly diseases to try experimental treatments and bypass the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The so-called Right to Try Act of 2017, sponsored by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, unanimously passed the Senate last August and cleared the House last week on a party-line vote of 250 to 169, a win for both Johnson and the Trump administration. Yesterday at the public signing ceremony, you might have seen Trump embracing the young boy who has a form of, I believe, muscular dystrophy. Here's a couple of comments that Trump made in his signing statement.
With the Right to Try law I'm signing today, patients with life-threatening illnesses will finally have access to experimental treatments that could improve or even cure their conditions. These are experimental treatments and products that have shown great promise, and we weren't able to use them before. The Right to Try also offers new hope for those who either don't qualify for clinical trials or who have exhausted all available treatment options.
Jim, this is something the president mentioned in the State of the Union address. It might have been one of the few moments where you got people from both parties applauding at that time. It took longer than it should have to get this through Congress. But this is basically great. The government getting out of the way and allowing people to make their own choice about experimental treatments when the conventional ones appear to be a lost cause.
Yeah. If you have ever lost someone to a dread disease such as cancer, it is not that uncommon where they reach a point where things are looking bad and they are mentioned, well, there are clinical trials of a potential new drug, an experimental drug. And then, of course, the patient very much wants to get into that, very much wants to try that, very much. You look, they're already in a situation where they are facing a terminal disease. At this point, to them, the risk, the potential side effects, the possibility that it won't work are all worth the risk because of the, you know, nature of the terminal circumstances. People I know have been in this situation. There's always the question of, are you healthy enough to qualify for the types of trials and tests and studies that are going on? For obvious reasons, those who want to develop these drugs want to, you know, have the patients try using them when there's still a better chance at success. But I remember, you know, a friend of my wife's and I, you know, she had wanted to get thought about the possibility of things, just simply didn't qualify. The paperwork, all the rigmarole, all the things you have to go through did not work for this, did not work fast enough. And she passed away. And we were discussing it afterwards. And then somebody said, why couldn't they get into this program? I said, look, because this is how this sort of coverage goes, that you end up with a, why aren't they letting people use these sorts of experimental drugs? And then the FDA and various parts of the government would begin to take kind of a step in that direction. And then inevitably, there'd be some sort of counter argument of, oh my goodness, can you believe that the FDA and doctors are letting patients take these risky experimental drugs that have no excuse? And they're, oh, aren't they playing on desperate people and stuff like that? And I suppose that's a concern worth having. But in the end, we're talking about people with terminal diseases. So at this point, they don't have that much to lose. Maybe it's false hope. We won't really know until we do more of the experiments, until we try more of the trials, the efforts to allow people to try using them. It always seemed rather cruel to not allow people to try something that might prolong their life, might mitigate their symptoms, might improve their health a bit for their time on earth. And, you know, you never know, might even conceivably cure them. I always kind of wanted to have as open mind as possible. This always struck me as very common sense legislation. You know, it's worth noting for all the griping, oh, Washington doesn't do anything and all that stuff, Congress has been passing a decent number of bills on fairly bipartisan efforts. There was the repeal of Dodd-Frank that was meant to make it easier for smaller banks to grow. There has been progress in Washington, and this is one worth celebrating, one that we all hope to never have to need. But if God forbid that day ever comes, at least we have a few more options when it comes to fighting some of the most dread diseases on earth.
Absolutely. I mean, the Declaration of Independence gives us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The government really shouldn't even be in a position where it needs to give us the right to try. But the fact that they have this additional flexibility is definitely a good thing. So kudos to Senator Johnson for leading the way on that and for all those who supported it. And obviously the president for signing it into law. Jim, that was a pretty heavy good martini, obviously, given that it's good news for people in very difficult situations. So let's lighten the mood a little bit as we go to our second good martini. I didn't know this until yesterday, but apparently HBO followed around different figures in the Obama administration for roughly the last year of the Obama presidency. One of them was Samantha Power, the president's last ambassador to the UN, and another one was his deputy national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, if we've talked about in such glowing terms here over the years, especially his effort to openly manipulate the media to paint a favorable picture of the Iran nuclear deal. And he pretty much admitted in an interview along the way that it was all a bunch of calculated garbage because they knew the media would pretty much just lap up whatever information they gave them. Well, they also followed these folks on election night 2016. They caught up with Ben Rhodes outside of whatever victory party he was at, maybe it was the main one in New York City, and the race had just been called for President Trump. Hillary Clinton had just conceded, and that's when HBO caught up with Ben Rhodes. Listen in.
I just came outside to try to process all this. It's a lot to process. I mean, I can't even. I can't put it into words. I don't know what the words are. I mean,
Jim, I remember in our year-end awards in 2016, I think we both selected the sobbing, weeping, and gnashing of teeth at the Javits Center when it became clear that Hillary Clinton was not going to break the glass ceiling, but more importantly, that she wasn't going to be president of the United States. So which do you enjoy more, that or Ben Rhodes completely speechless, given his role in this administration, at the results in 2016?
You know, Greg, I'm going to have to go with Rhodes because, I mean, not only is that a pregnant pause that's having octuplets, when your speechwriter says, I can't find the words, I don't know the words, that's kind of your job, isn't it? I mean, that's what the speechwriter is supposed to do, is find the right words for the moment. You kind of summarized it well, Greg, that look, there, you know, it's not merely policy disagreements with Ben Rhodes that makes him stand out. There were a bunch of people who supported the Iran deal, which you and I both were not fans of and saw as a very wrongheaded approach to a very dangerous regime. The way Ben Rhodes discussed it in a New York Times interview was an assessment that the White House press corps understood nothing about Iran and the Middle East and the history of the region and the nature of the regime and the issues at play, you know, that they understood none of this. And thus, he could simply tell them things and they would report it as fact without consulting anybody else or getting contrary perspectives or anything like that. The shamelessness with which he bragged about this was kind of striking to the New York Times. I mean, you assume the New York Times correspondent he's speaking to knows the people the New York Times has on the beat covering the White House. And he's basically saying, yeah, your colleagues are a bunch of gullible idiots who will run whatever I tell them. And you know, the frightening possibility was that Ben Rhodes is right. I think there's a strong argument that the level of knowledge amongst the average political correspondent is not what it ought to be, perhaps not at what it was a generation ago. There was the tale of the person on the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016 who said, what's Whitewater? things that you just should know if you're covering these sorts of things. But also it's the kind of, you know, the contempt he had, not just for him, but for the public. The idea that he wasn't obligated to give a full accounting of it. The lack of accountability on him by this know-nothing White House press corps and kind of diplomatic corps, the people who cover arms control and international diplomacy and things like that. He really quite enjoyed this. He really relished the fact that there were very few people who were in a position to know when he was BSing them or spinning them or giving them, that's very much a, let's just say, a skewed version of events or the truth, and the, how easily he could, you know, I would argue, smear critics of the Iran deal, calling them as warmongers and in, you know, in Israel's corner and all that kind of stuff. Ben Rhodes earned this. You know, was he surprised by Trump's win? Yes, a lot of people were surprised by Trump's win. That's not the shame of it. It's the sputtering, just, you know, this is the moment at the end of Usual Suspects where he drops his coffee cup and he suddenly realizes Kaiser Soze has been sitting in front of him the whole time. Oh, by the way, spoiler alert. That he really, you know, he's never quite contemplated the possibility that Trump could win this presidency. And I could be wrong. I have a feeling that what's filling in the gaps in those long, awkward, stammering silences is his recognition that the Iran deal, one of the Ben Rhodes's key projects in the White House, was not a treaty, never passed the Senate, and that thus President Trump would be able to rescind it. And he basically did. The Paris Climate Accords were the same sort of thing. TPP, a good chunk of the Obama foreign policy agenda, particularly in the second term, was all done through executive orders and executive actions and decisions and staffing and stuff like that, and had not been done by treaties, thus making it very easy for the next president to rescind. And they never really worried about that because they were so convinced the next president was going to be a Democrat and all likelihood it was going to be Hillary Clinton. Reality crashes into him and it just leaves him devastated. Greg, if I were German, I would just say in today's Three Martini Lunch, his Schadenfreude tastes like apple strudel. It's delicious. And I'm not one for the, delicious liberal tears philosophy of politics, but sometimes you just watch somebody on the other side really get handed a kick in the crotch defeat, and you just have to sit and smile and just cherish the moment, Greg.
Wow. So that's the gold medal in liberal reaction to election night 2016, followed by the Javits Center. And I would guess the Obama White House staff dressed all in black while he made his statement the next morning probably would take the bronze. But fascinating stuff, fascinating stuff. And then, of course, that led to a whole bunch of protests for Trump's inauguration and a lot of other events since then, largely perpetrated by a bunch of people who don't smell very good, which leads us directly to the Dollar Shave Club. And I got to thank Dollar Shave Club. I was minding my own business last week when my wife sent me a text message and said, did you order a bunch of stuff from the Dollar Shave Club? I said, I'm not sure. She's like, well, they sent you a bunch of stuff. It's a huge box that smells like man. And so I said, well, great. Well,
it smells like Greg.
I can't wait to try it out. Now, I'm a very simple person when it comes to personal grooming. All I need is a razor and shaving cream, soap, deodorant, toothbrush, toothpaste. I'm good. Maybe a comb. I do need a comb. And that's it. And so you think some of the stuff, well, I'll definitely try it out. And I'll tell you, I'm only starting because I just got this stuff. But as much as I love the Dr. Carver shave butter, I think the Dr. Carver's shave lather is just as good. It actually makes your face tingle and gives you a close shave. It reminds me, Jim, of remember those shampoo commercials in the 80s where the guy would soap up one side of his head with one shampoo and the other side with another, and one would tingle, so he knew that one was working or something? Well, that's how it makes your face feel. And if you're not into caffeine, it's a great way to wake up in the morning. So shave butter or shave lather, you are in good shape. But if you ever shower or brush your teeth or try to make your hair look presentable, we've got some good news for you, because Dollar Shave Club has a lot of stuff to help you out. Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to get ready each morning.
Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that will leave your tush feeling tingly clean. I'm a big fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. I've never smelled anything like it. Good luck finding a product that great at the store. All of Dollar Shave Club's products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You will feel the difference. And don't forget, shipping is included with your membership.
And here is a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products for very little money. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with Body Cleanser, the One Wipe Charlies, yes, those are the amazing butt wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six Blade Executive. Really good stuff. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks per month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need for the bathroom. Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/martini. That's dollarshaveclub.com/martini. All right, Jim, for our third good martini, we've got to hop in the Wayback Machine, all the way back to yesterday, when you explained very, very well how the right and the left trampled over you, switching sides in the free speech debate between the NFL kneeling controversy and what happened to Roseanne following her tweet about Valerie Jarrett. And for those who weren't here yesterday, Roseanne obviously lost her show. She tweeted that Valerie Jarrett was basically a combination of the Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes. Deplorable comments in every conceivable way. But the question did arise in many different circles. Well, what about liberals when they say things that are completely inappropriate about other people that perhaps more liberal network executives don't mind as much if they insult? Well, Jim, it took us, a day to get the prime example of this. Samantha Bee used to be on The Daily Show. Now she's got a TBS comedy show called Full Frontal, which ought to prepare you for her content. But she was talking about a photo that Ivanka Trump posted over Memorial Day weekend. It was just her and her toddler son. Now, just a sweet moment. But of course, because she's a Trump, the social media world decided to just trash her for it. And Samantha Bee went even one worse.
You know, Ivanka, that's a beautiful photo of you and your child. But let me just say, one mother to another, do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless c-. He listens to you. Put on something tight and low cut and tell your father to f***ing stop it. Tell him it was an Obama thing and see how it goes, okay? We'll be right back.
So in addition to perhaps the most vile word in the English language, she's accusing the president's daughter of a relationship that is grossly inappropriate. Jim, this also comes as there's more info about Joy Reid's former blog that she still claims was hacked. First, there was the comments about, was it gays and transgenders a while back? And now there's evidence that she was pushing 9/11 truther theories. So this just got fired right back up again.
Yeah, and people might be asking, well, you know, Jim, Greg, how could this be a good martini? Look, I don't like the double standard that we have in our popular political discourse. As I've said many times, I could live very happily in a world with polite political discourse, where you had to focus on substance, where, you know, insults and mocking and language like this, the one that Samantha Bee used, were considered grossly inappropriate and out of bounds. And you know, that whenever you used it, you'd get a near universal rebuke. Or I could live happily in a world where no holds are barred, where anybody can say whatever they want. First Amendment absolutist. It's the Wild West. You know, life is tough. Wear a cup. But I want whatever standard there is to be applied universally. And you're automatically going to hear a lot of, well, look, it's a comedian. It's different. It's okay for that. But, you know, of course, Roseanne is a comedian. You know, I don't really understand why there would be worlds of difference. Look, I think it's inappropriate to say Valerie Jarrett, compare her to a Planet of the Apes character. And I think it's inappropriate to say the things that Samantha Bee said about Ivanka Trump. But there's a huge difference here. Roseanne just had her show canceled and has effectively been excommunicated from civil society, right? That she is, you know, she's made to walk the plank. We cannot tolerate this. So everything associated with Roseanne must stop immediately. Samantha Bee is getting an award tonight. Now, why is this good? Because I would argue, Greg, that if you're going to have a double standard and you don't like it, a subtle one is very hard to push back against. It's very hard to get people to notice, to be bothered by, to get riled up by, and to get angry enough about to push back against. But when it's this glaring, I think it makes it better and easier. I mean, you're already seeing people, you know, trying to say, as I explained, you know, well, this comedian is okay and that comedian isn't. I'd love to see people say, you know, is it okay to use the C word? I'd argue no. I would argue you can make whatever argument you want to make. And I say this as a guy who's had to do a lot of ampersands and pound signs and at signs and percentage signs and all kinds of other stuff on Twitter to express the words that I'd like to use. If we want to make the C word a you know, automatic timeout word, so to speak, fine, let's do that, right? Let's make it very clear that even for comedians, this is not okay. Or everything is okay, one or the other. Whatever it is, wherever, you know, whatever standard we want to have, we're going to have. But you can't have one standard when you're mocking somebody who, like Valerie Jarrett or the Obamas, and a completely different standard when you're criticizing the Trump family. And that's what the Samantha Bees of the world want to have. As for Joy Reid, you know, look, if she had said, yeah, it's 2006, I wrote some things that are considered homophobic today, I really regret it, my thinking on gays and transgender people hasn't evolved, some of us might grumble, oh, she got off with an apology, but fine. Well, Joy Reid didn't give the apology. She claimed she was hacked, that somebody out there decided that her now defunct 2006 blog was exactly the way to destroy her, and that they took posts that she herself had written and inserted bad and homophobic and statements in there. A lot of people scoffed at it. Allegedly, she had her cyber expert contact the FBI. You can't see all the air quotes that I'm making. As I say, cyber expert, she was hacked, et cetera, et cetera. But now we find out she was promoting that, you know, cockamamie conspiracy theory documentary. And I'm, again, making air quotes as I say that, Loose Change. And, you know, MSNBC had no comment. She declined comment. You know, I mean, like, how many different passes do you get? Like, you know, the first, there's the homophobic statement, the not admitting the homophobic statement, but making up this cockamamie story about being hacked. And now you're a 9/11 truther. The honest answer here, or what I think really is going on here, is that if you look back, there was one survey that put this up, and I think it was, I linked to it in the Morning Jolt, back in 2006, asked whether people in the U.S. government were involved in 9/11 or they let 9/11 happen in order to justify future Middle Eastern wars. More than half of the Democrats polled said they thought it was likely or somewhat likely. So 9/11 trutherism back in 2006 was not crazy fringe. You know, if you were a Democrat, there was a pretty good chance that if you weren't a 9/11 truther, somebody you knew was a 9/11 truther. Now, again, I think this is appalling. I think it's a ridiculous example of what, you know, we now call Bush derangement syndrome. And for everybody who's, you know, really, really upset about President Trump and the way he approaches the presidency and his policies and his character, well, gee, maybe if you'd been nicer to George W. Bush, you would have had people appreciating things like character and decorum and manners and all that kind of stuff. This is what you get. And kind of to close with a final thought, it's half formed. So grade me on a curve with this one. When I see Republicans kind of shrugging at what Roseanne said, or the president in his more frothing at the mouth moments, or there are a lot of folks on the right who say and do things to be provocative, to be, you know, deliberately offend people, to really jab at them, that aren't constructive, that aren't, you know, necessarily advancing an argument, that are just basically made to attack somebody else, and you could argue are toxic for our discourse. But, you know, you see, for obvious reasons, people on the right very rarely want to fully rebuke. It's not like they're going to abandon Trump over it. It's not like they're going to abandon any of the right of center voices that have kind of attracted Ann Coulter, you know, any of those folks. And what I suspect we're seeing here is kind of the equivalent of jury nullification. Now, younger listeners may not remember this during the O.J. Simpson trial, but this was a concept that people had said that, look, when you lose faith in the police force, when you lose faith in the law enforcement's ability to apply the law equally, to treat suspects with respect, to not engage in police brutality, to not plant evidence, all that kind of stuff. When you lose faith in that, the argument of jury nullification was, we don't care what evidence you're going to present to us. We're going to let the defendant walk as a vote of no confidence in the legal system. Now, a lot of us thought that was not a particularly good idea. Even if it works, there's a good chance you're going to put a violent, you know, criminal back on the streets. Some people argue about whether that was what was at play in the O.J. Simpson verdict. But I think what we're seeing here is that same mentality of, I don't trust the people who are attempting to enforce this rule of what is beyond the pale. That they only are interested in enforcing it on one group of people, and they always give a pass to another group of people. They very much care who says it. They very much care who is the target of the ridicule. And because it is so glaringly one-sided, because it is such a glaring double standard, I will not, quote unquote, vote to convict, meaning criticize somebody on my side who does something like this. I don't like this, but I think that's kind of a reflection of where we are, Greg. And if we want this to change, then TBS has to, at the very least, give be some sort of consequence for this. It doesn't necessarily have to be a fallout cancellation of the show, but you know, we saw Laura Ingraham have her, you know, take a vacation from her show. Not every offensive statement has to be a firing offense. But I do think there has to be some sort of consequence where the people who run these networks and who run these venues need to say, you know, that's not in keeping with the tone we want to have. That crossed a line. We don't think that's appropriate. And Greg, if you and I start dropping the F-bomb left and right, first of all, I don't think we'd ever see the light of day. I think somewhere along the line, they would say, yeah, we're not doing this episode of Three Martini Lunch. It wouldn't reflect what Radio America stands for. It wouldn't reflect what National Review stands for. And I think it's kind of fair to ask to the likes of MSNBC and TBS, is this what you stand for? And if not, you need to speak up and say so.
Well said. Well said. That wasn't half-baked. That was excellent.
Well, a little more time in the oven since when I first thought of it.
Yes, exactly. I will point out, though, while I haven't watched CNN exhaustively this morning, I have not seen them address the Samantha Bee comment at all. Whereas, of course, they spent over 24 hours straight talking about Roseanne. Apply your lesson there, as you have. So, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
All right. See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And a reminder to visit our good friends over at Dollar Shave Club. For just $5, you get the Daily Essentials Starter Set. Order it now. DollarShaveClub.com/martini. And tune in again Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.